Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Friday, November 12, 2021. Political parties in Sudan have rejected the decision by military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to appoint a new sovereign council.
Our stand as an Islamic political party, we don't recognize this council.
And the Juba Electricity Distribution Company issued arrest warrants against members of the non-profit Defy Hate Now.
They went in person to the office of YETCO and informed them that our meter seems not to be counting what's happening. So they sent a team, and the team came and found out that there was a bypass.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese political parties have rejected military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's announcement of a new sovereign council. Thursday evening, al-Burhan announced the names of 13 members of the council after more than 2 weeks of constitutional vacuum in the country. But political party leaders say the action is unconstitutional and puts the country on a path towards military rule. The parties vow to continue opposing the new military government until full democratic and civilian rule is restored. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
In a decree announced on state-owned TV and radio, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan appointed himself the head of the new sovereign council. His deputies include the paramilitary leader Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo and three other top military officers who were members of the initial council. He also reappointed Malik Agar, Al-Hadi Idris, and Al-Tahir Hajar to represent the armed opposition groups that signed the Juba peace agreement with the government last year. Al-Burhan says lawyer Raja Nicola Abdul Masih, the only Christian in the council, remains in her position. The newly civilian members include Yusuf Jad Karim Muhammad, Abul Qasim Muhammad Ahmad, Abdul Baghi Abdul Gadir Al-Zubair, and Salma Abdul Jabbar Al-Mubarak. The decree says consultations are still underway to appoint a 14th member of the council to represent Eastern Sudan. Sudanese political parties rejected the appointment of the new council. They say it violates the constitutional declaration that was the basis of the transitional government following the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via phone, Kamal Omar, the acting Secretary General for the pro-Islamic Popular Congress Party, described the decision as mocking the Sudanese people. He says they will not cooperate with any government that is imposed against the will of the people.
Our stand as an Islamic political party, we don't recognize this council. We are against any government that comes through a coup. We are against the coup and against these appointments that only serve the interests of the military over the interest of the true democratic transformation.
On October 25th, General al-Burhan dissolved the cabinet and suspended some articles of the constitutional declaration. He accused some political parties of excluding the military from taking part in the transitional government. Omar says he expects protesters to come out across the country on Saturday to reject any government imposed to replace the civilian transitional government that people want.
In my opinion, the anger and the participation in the protest will be huge given the fact about the new appointment. We will send a strong and clear message against this appointment. I don't expect any political stability in Sudan. We are at a real scam about the constitution and a democratic transition.
On Friday, Liz Throssell, the spokesperson of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said the commissioner has stressed that inclusive dialogue is needed to swiftly return Sudan to civilian rule. Throssell said the appointment of the new council is a setback in efforts to do that. She also urged the government to respect the rights of Sudanese to protest peacefully and call for restraint from the military during demonstrations expected on Saturday. Amal Azain is a member of the political bureau of Sudanese Communist Party. She also rejected the newly announced Sovereign Council, saying there is no way the Sudanese people could accept to be ruled by an authoritarian military government again after 3 decades under Bashir's rule.
There is no way that you seize power by force and impose a sovereign council and a cabinet without any legal constitutional power, rather than the power of the weapon. They have not considered any opinion of the people who actually ousted the previous regime.
As Zain vows to continue protesting, she says the Sudanese people have the upper hand in deciding their future.
The Communist Party will be present on the streets and among its people regardless of any reaction of the military against the people. For us, this is a clear military coup and it's our sole responsibility to resist them through all peaceful means.
General Al-Burhan was sworn in last night as the head of the newly appointed Sovereign Council. Other members are yet to take the oath of office. The United Nations Special Envoy to Sudan, Volker Perthes, on Friday tweeted that Al-Burhan's move makes it harder to return to constitutional order. The United States, Britain, Norway, and the European Union on Friday said the appointment of the new council violated the 2019 constitutional declaration. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A U.S.-based Sudan analyst says the appointment of a new sovereign council by Al-Burhan shows the military is proceeding with completing the October 25th takeover despite international efforts to reverse it, a move that he says could force the international community to impose sanctions on Sudan. Suleiman Baldo, who is a senior policy analyst at the U.S.-based think tank The Century, tells me Sudan's military leaders are trying to appoint to government civilians who agree with their agenda and remain submissive to the army.
The Putschists are picking and choosing their own civilians. The transition in Sudan was agreed upon and constitutionally codified as a partnership between the military and civilians in a civilian-led transitional government that should place Sudan on track for democracy by 2023. This is not the case today. The initial constitutional declaration gave full executive powers to a civilian cabinet. This decision doesn't change much of the nature of the putsch. It remains a military regime whereby the military hold sway and whereby they choose and handpick the civilian representative they want as a representative in the Sovereignty Council. But very soon we know that they will proceed to nominate a prime minister and a cabinet of their own choosing to ensure that it will be and remain submissive to the volunteer and to the decision of the military.
We saw similar faces who were members of the Sovereignty Council that General Burhan dissolved on October 25th, including the top 3 military generals, Burhan himself, Himeti, and Kabashi. We also saw the reinstatement of leaders of the armed movements that signed a peace agreement with him, and a few civilian faces. How do you see the composition of this newly appointed council?
I'm not sure why the composition came in the way that it was announced. The 3 representatives of the Sudan Revolutionary Front, that's to say two Darfur movements and the Sudan Liberation Movement North, the faction of Malik Agar and Yasser Arman, these 3 movements have issued a joint statement rejecting the coup d'etat, considering it as non-constitutional and demanding a return to the prior arrangement where, civilians led the transition. And therefore, by nominating them again to the Sovereignty Council, I believe, the military are trying to embarrass them, either accepting, their representation, and therefore basically walking away from their earlier, repudiation of the coup d'etat, or inducing them to basically insist on their position and therefore replace them with others again that are handpicked from the armed movements aligned with the coup d'etat. And there wouldn't be any shortage of those. In fact, two Darfur movements aligned themselves with the coup prior to the coup by calling for it and after it by standing in as spokespeople for justifying the takeover of the army of the entire transitional process, such as the Justice and Equality Movement and Sudan Liberation Movement of Mini Minawi.
Regional and international efforts are still ongoing to restore a civilian-led government in Sudan. So when General Burhan unilaterally appoints a sovereign council, how does it sit with the mediation process underway?
Burhan is proceeding with establishment of fait accompli on the ground by, you know, appointing this interim sovereignty council. He is basically turning the international community and all the mediation efforts led by the Troika and the U.S. and the Arab League or African Union, South Sudan, and all the international efforts, as well as, you know, committees of five men and women who mediated between the civilian and military components in the transition, trying to reconcile them and reach, you know, a negotiated, you know, settlement to their disagreement to allow the transition to proceed. So by taking this action, he's, you know, basically telling everyone this: we are not interested in a negotiated solution. And I think this will increase the isolation of the coup d'etat in the international community, and it will invite a response from the international community that is beyond a simple, you know, appeals or simple, you know, threats of action and consequences for the putschist. I believe we're going to a period where there will be basically sanctioned for their action for disrupting a peaceful transition to democracy and ending a constitutional order.
How do you see this move contributing to an already extremely volatile situation in Sudan with the street protests, you know, amid an internet blackout, you know, and everything else?
The street protests are not going to weaken or disappear. These are grassroots and, you know, basically total mobilization of the Sudanese population that don't want to see a new military regime sitting on their shoulders and basically capturing all state resources, as has happened in 52 years of Sudan, 62, you know, years of independence. And therefore, you know, it's going to be rejected. It vindicates the position of those opposing the coup that, after all, this is, you know, a repressive dictatorship, and the coup is basically proving it in the level of violence that is exercising, and unlawful detentions and beatings of peaceful protesters for simply expressing their opinion. So I think the country will continue to be in a situation of destabilization for quite some time. I don't expect anything would calm down until the military step aside and allow the transition to proceed.
That was Suleiman Baldo, senior analyst at the investigative group, The Sentry. And from Sudan, we move to the South Sudanese capital, Juba, where a row is brewing between a non-profit organization known as Defy Hate Now and Juba Electricity Distribution Company, or JETCO, over an alleged illegal power connection. JETCO has issued the non-profit a $98,000 bill for electricity over the last 7 months. But Defy Hate Now says the bill is exorbitant and unfair. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Defy Hate Now says in March it went to JETCO and asked to be connected to electricity. It says JETCO sent someone to connect the office to phase one, that is a phase where the client uses minimum electrical appliances. Rach Malwal, the lawyer representing Defy Hate Now, says the organization used the power for a short time, then started experiencing repeated short circuits, which it reported to JETCO. He says JETCO advised Defy Hate Now to upgrade to phase 3, where the client uses power for several electrical appliances. He says the non-profit agreed to change to phase 3, but after 4 months, the group realized that the meter was not recording the increased amount of units being used. Malwal advised his client to report the case to JETCO.
They went in person to the office of JETCO and informed them that our meter seems not to be counting what's happening. So they sent a team, and the team came and found out that there was a bypass. When they found out there was a bypass, this is when this whole thing was invited. And instead of knowing there was a good faith, they went ahead and made their own assessment. And that assessment says that for 5 months, the DeFi head now will have to pay $95,000, which is $19,000 per each month, of which we all know the DeFi head now office does not have that capacity.
Malal says JETCO should have first looked at the details of the phase one meter that was used before to know how much power the organization was using in a month, then use that detail to calculate for the other months instead of slapping the organization with an inflated amount. He says after several engagements, he was surprised to hear from JETCO that the person who connected the organization to phase three does not work for JETCO. Malal says on Wednesday, JETCO called his client Marina Modi to go and write a police statement on the matter. He says instead, police locked her up for 9 hours.
We pressed them that please take the statement, but they never wanted to take till the end of the day, until we had to do an undertaking. So the JETCO are interested for a settlement, and we are going to go to them and we'll see what will be the outcome of the settlement. If there is no any outcome of the settlement, we will opt that this case will be taken ahead to the court of law.
Joseph Thomas, public relations manager at JETCO, acknowledges that the company asked for an arrest warrant for DeFi Hate Now, but says it was because the group did not comply with JETCO's decisions.
They did not even come a report until we have an inspection team that move always in the neighborhood who does an inspection. To one day visit their premises and visit them to find out the meter connected there is already stolen, and to find out the connection was also a bypass connection, and also at the same time to find out this meter belonged to somebody.
Thomas says DeFi Hate Now argued that they were legally connected by someone who had JETCO ID, but he says they asked the organization to identify the person and they did not. He says the group also didn't present receipts for the electricity it had used. He says a JETCO team went to DeFi Hate Now office and made an assessment of the electricity they had used over 7 months and gave the group the bill. Thomas says DeFi Hate Now can get their own electrician who can assess the electrical appliances in the office and compare that with what JETCO has done. But if the organization wants to go to court, then the company is ready to defend itself. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, dozens of South Sudanese university students are stranded in Ethiopia because of the fighting there. Find out more on that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite meal?
I like chips and anything braai, whether chicken or beef.
My favorite meal is our fish, mainly jambo, and local vegetables like nkwani.
I love chapati. Like, I don't know why I love chapati, but I just love chapati. There's no reason for loving it. Like, chapati every day.
My favorite meal is jollof and rice with chicken. That will be best for me.
My favorite food, matoke, that is banana and beans. Banana and beans, yes.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Dozens of South Sudanese students studying at Ethiopian University say they're stranded and have nothing to eat after they were evacuated to the capital as fighting between government forces and Tigray rebels spread to the Amhara region. One of the students spoke of struggling to find food and living in fear. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Most schools and universities across Ethiopia remain closed. More than 7,000 schools have been damaged as a result of the expanding conflict in that country, with 1.42 million students unable to attend classes in the war-torn region of Tigray. Most South Sudanese students studying in universities in the Amhara region have been left stranded after schools were closed. Yuwal Majungarang, a first-year student of environmental science at Wailata Sodo University, says lectures have been suspended until further notice because of the insecurity in the area. Garang says the students' living conditions have worsened since the South Sudan embassy evacuated them to Addis Ababa a few days ago.
Don't know when we're going back to school. Problem right now is that we're just relying on our parents, and we were coming here for full scholarship. A few things should be funded by South Sudanese embassy. And now South Sudanese embassy, they're not helping us with anything. We don't have any support from our parents, and we're just relying on them. But right now, they're not saying anything as if we're going back or not. We're just staying here what's going on.
Garang says she is disappointed that the South Sudan government took so long to respond and facilitate the evacuation of its students. She urges South Sudanese officials to either provide the students with basic needs at the embassy or take the students to South Sudan immediately.
I'm thinking they can take us back, and they can bring us back when they reopen the school. Because some of us, we can't even afford the ticket to go back and come back, you know? We can't afford the ticket to go to Dubai and come back. So we're just thinking they can pay our ticket two ways, going and coming back.
Lokodu Joseph Banaya, a third-year computer engineering student at Bahirdar University, says students are facing hardships and struggling to survive after Ethiopian authorities closed universities and asked foreign students to leave. He says students' representatives are talking with officials from the South Sudan embassy to help them go home.
When they called off the class, of course we were part of our students because we were also running. I mean, we were fighting against time. And so calling off the classes affected us directly because we had to suspend classes and time is not by our side. That's why we got bothered about that. Yes, we were bothered. As a person, I really got bothered about it so much.
South Sudan's ambassador to Ethiopia, James Morgan, says 21 out of 59 South Sudanese students studying under government scholarship in Amhara region have been evacuated to Addis Ababa because the crisis there posed danger to their lives. Morgan says there is no money at the embassy to maintain the students, but he says the embassy is using the limited resources available to take care of the students for the time being, as he waits on Juba to help get them home.
Juba is the one arranging. We are waiting for the Juba to make that arrangement. And when that arrangement is done, they will go to Juba. And when the universities are open, they will come back. Those who arrived yesterday are put in guest house waiting for the process. We are providing them temporarily for the time being, but Juba will send something today. At the embassy, we don't have money.
There are more than 300 South Sudanese students studying in Ethiopia. Media reports say that the Tigray People's Liberation Front is pressing forward toward Addis Ababa. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
Aircraft manufacturer Boeing has accepted sole liability for the March 2019 737 MAX crash in Ethiopia, which killed 157 people. In a statement on Wednesday, Boeing said it is committed to ensuring that all families who lost loved ones in the accident are fully and fairly compensated. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, lawyers for the families have described the agreement as an important step toward justice.
According to the legal documents filed on Wednesday in a Chicago court, Boeing admitted liability for the accident that happened in Ethiopia in March 2019, claiming 157 lives. The documents, however, do not mention specific amounts to be paid out to the families of the victims. Lawyers representing the victims noted in a statement that Boeing admitted under the agreement that the 737 MAX had an unsafe condition and that it will not attempt to blame anyone else for the crash. Laban Opande is one of the lawyers representing families of the victims.
So in this case, Boeing has been, of course, denying that they were not liable, that there was nothing defectful or there was nothing wrong with the aircraft caused the accident to happen. And so that has been a main big bone of contention because it's kind of hard to move to the next phase, which is usually the compensation, unless the airline had admitted that they were liable. So they have admitted that indeed indeed there was a manufacturer's defect on the aircraft, and that defect is actually what caused the crash.
The compensation is a milestone for the families in their pursuit of justice against Boeing, as it will ensure the families are all treated equitably and eligible to recover full damages under the American law. The compensation serves to hold Boeing fully accountable for the deaths of 157 people. Ibrahim Hamed lost his son in the ill-fated plane. He spoke to Citizen TV Kenya saying, "It is better when the matter is solved on time in order to save his family from court visits."
He was working with Al Marai in Saudi Arabia, where he used to supervise in a farm. You see, he had that post. It is better we settle this matter on time so that we stop making trips to courts. Our loved ones are not there anymore. No matter what we get, it can't help us get them back to life.
Lawyer Opande says some families had already settled the matter out of court before Boeing admitted liability.
Some families had been in discussions with the airline and they had agreed to settle out of court. So as a matter of fact, quite a number of families have been in discussions with the aircraft carrier, with Boeing, to settle out of court. And so that has happened even prior to this admission of liability. But for those who have settled, it has been more of, you know, just wanting to move on and, you know, bring some kind of closure to this ordeal that they have had for the last 2 years or so.
Boeing's 737 MAX plane was grounded for 20 months after 346 people died in two different 737 MAX crashes, one in Indonesia in 2018 and another one in Ethiopia in 2019. The plane returned to service after Boeing made significant software and training improvements. The crashes already have cost Boeing about $20 billion. Next week, Tuesday, a judge has set a hearing on the compensation agreement. Reporting for viewers, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's all we have for you this Friday. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your vehicles, homes, and on your phones. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect yourself and others from coronavirus. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for COVID-19. Join us again Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.
Kuruju ya odeza mata kuruju ka yuma uza mata kuruju ka mweledi uza mata kuruju ka yaba uza mata kuruju ka iti Kalena kuruju ya odesa mata kuruju ja kuma kalena kuruju uza mata kuruju ja uwele di.